Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is a woman who I met at a conference called the WITAN, a semi-secret conference that took place at Warwick University, and she's called Aidin Paladin, and she's done some extremely interesting YouTube videos on academic questions and all kinds of stuff, and she's a recovering academic herself. Aidin, hello.
Hi, great to be here, and it was great to meet you at the WITAN, yeah.
It was good fun. Tell me, one of the things that fascinated me about the WITAN, actually, which for people that aren't familiar with it, was just sort of a meeting of base conservative types, was the number of women there. I didn't think there'd be any. apparently there is a growing portion of women who, in effect, are kind of almost like anti-feminist. They dressed in a certain way, a certain kind of traditional, modest sort of way, and there was at least 10% of the people there were that. So what would a person like you, a millennial, whatever, what would draw an intelligent, intellectual, youngish woman into being anti-feminist?
I think it's pretty obvious when you look at the state of modern women that they're largely unhappy. And if you look at the statistical polling on that, women are extremely unhappy comparatively to the past, because what has been replaced is what is valuable, what is sold as being valuable to women are material goods and this a reckless, a temporary lifestyle rather than forming long-term friendships, bonds, and really with having families. And that's just not fulfilling. It's hedonic pleasure, but it's not eudaimonic meaningfulness. And so women, I think, are fighting back against this thing that's been actually very harmful to not just their lives, but to the lives of people they know, other women, and to men as well. And I think more and more women are starting to see that. And so there is a pushback against particularly more modern elements of feminism. But I think then it goes down to even the most basic elements of men and women being equal as being a false premise.
So what are these more modern elements of feminism to which these traditionalist girls object?
I think that's the hedonic stuff more than anything. There's a, you know, of course, the moral foundations theory that there is some people just have a higher sensitivity to disgust. And I think that for those women who have that higher sensitivity to disgust, a higher loading on the purity, valuing purity, that they find a lot of these hedonic things that have become not just normalized, but made to be lauded in society of being degenerate. There's a rejection to that because it creates that disgust reaction, which is actually quite normal, evolutionarily speaking.
And what are the basics of feminism that these women see as a problem? I mean, hasn't feminism, to play the devil's advocate here, hasn't feminism given you all kinds of opportunities? Isn't it because of feminism that we're even having this conversation? I'm taking you seriously as a female thinker. I wouldn't have taken you seriously as a female thinker 100 years ago. There wouldn't have been a female thinker doing YouTube videos and doing a PhD at the University of West Virginia or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. You'd get married and have babies. You wouldn't be there going around expressing your views.
I'm not sure that's entirely true throughout the course of history. I actually think that, of course, there's the truism or idiom, whichever you want to call it, of behind every great man, there's a great woman, et cetera. But I think, obviously there have been examples of women who have been involved in academia, particularly in lower level academia of teaching younger children for a long time. I think there's problems with that as well, potentially when it's unmitigated and done without any kind of things in place to make sure women don't teach children very insane stuff, which is one of the things that's happened in the last couple of decades, is using lower level education, primary school education, as an indoctrination tool rather than as an actual education tool. And I think a lot of that is women's doing. But I don't think that it was ever the case that women were actually ever totally kept out of any and all academic pursuits. So I think that where the kickback there, or the fight back against it, is it's the explosion of men and women are inherently evil or inherently equal. That I think is the premise that a lot of women are actually starting to think is faulty.
And so that's a very basic premise. And so why are they thinking that that's faulty? What's wrong with that idea? Aren't they the same men and women? Aren't they intellectually capable of the same things? Aren't they? How is that faulty?
Well, not in terms of statistics, of course, as I'm sure you're well aware, the standard deviation for women's intelligence is much narrower. So you have a very small number. Most women are around 100 IQ, but you don't get genius women, just like you don't get absolute absolutely just brain dead women to the same degrees that you get men who fall on, you know, either sides of the bell curve, because their standard deviation is wider. So I do think that, that's just an inherent difference right there in terms of women's intellect. You aren't going to get a whole lot of female geniuses. It just doesn't happen. There's no evolutionary rationale for women to develop extremely high intelligence. It makes more sense for them to all be around the mean. Whereas for men...
Why is that?
Because women are seeking... Women are seeking to reproduce, obviously. So you don't want strong aberrations, I think, because that can turn men off. you want to reproduce, so an extremely aberrant female is going to be less sexually desirable, potentially.
Why wouldn't she be desirable? Wouldn't men think that, oh, well, this is an intelligent woman, and I'm an intelligent man, and I'm passing on my genes intelligence is highly heritable, so you would expect intelligence to be something that is selected for sexually. And so, so wouldn't men want to go for intelligent women? No,
I think because very intelligent women, like very intelligent men, end up being a little bit weird, also, and socially and in other ways, because it just tends to be the case. If you're thinking about things too much, you tend to overthink things, and that can be socially awkward. And the same thing with extremely stupid women. Although I think they're more selected for, actually, just because they won't argue. You know, they're probably far more easygoing or easier to get along with. I mean, it also seems that men seem to select women who have mental illnesses for some reason, at least in terms of the attraction. I find that a lot. I don't know if there's actually any data on that.
But yeah, there is. Yeah, there is. I think this may be because those women are also sort of fast life history strategists. So they're easy. Yeah. Easy, like the mental illness telling the man that I can get sex out of this. What do you think has caused this kickback now? I mean, in the 90s, when I was coming of age, when I was a teenager, it was all women should be feminist, women should go to university, you know, all this sort of thing. And when I was at that conference, there were a number of women who were very intelligent, who had consciously decided to not go to university. They wanted to be traditionalists and they wanted to be housewives, which would have been completely unthinkable in the late 90s when I was about to go to university. The very idea that that would be someone's ambition was insane. So what do you think has led to this kickback against what was going on then?
I think it's, as I said, when you look at the polling data, women are miserable in terms of their self-reported rates of depression, their self-reported rates of mental illness, their self-reported rates of life satisfaction. It's all gone precipitously downward since, you know, the 1990s, as women's liberation, women's rights has expanded and more women have entered the workforce. Because, I mean, ultimately, women now it now takes two parents to raise a child, if they're even able to afford it at all. So women have to stay in the workforce. They don't have the option to stay at home. It's denigrated, actually. And what, like I said, you're finding is women are reporting this lower levels of happiness and they're not reporting meaningfulness in life. Many women are putting off having children altogether. Or because by the time they've achieved enough in their career or whatever they think they're supposed to have done, they're too old to have children. And then they're really left out of that sense of meaningfulness that traditionally has been it's the primary motivator for the human species, as any other species, is to reproduce. And women have essentially been lied to and saying, no, the thing that's going to make you happy, the thing that's going to make you fulfilled is having a career. And by having a career inherently basically means you're going to have to put off having children, particularly now that women, because of women's liberation, have to enter the workforce because it has to basically have a two-parent, two-income house household in order for most families to get by. So it's ended up putting women in a very tough place. You got what you wanted, but...
It's put women in an evolutionary mismatch. Mm-hmm. It's put women in a situation where they're evolutionary match. Presumably, they are evolved over the women that weren't submissive to the patriarchy. Presumably, they didn't pass on their genes; they were selected out. So you're going to have all these women that are submissive to the patriarchy, and then they will act accordingly. They will. Let's say you've got the parents are pushing you to marry someone that's in their genetic interests. You want to marry some Lothario, and then you end up with a balance between the two. But give women complete rights then to do whatever they want. And presumably, would that mean they'd go for some very unsuitable man as well?
Well, there's also the, particularly over the last 70 years, a very major issue is hormonal birth control, which fundamentally changes the types of men that women are attracted to. And it also, when women stop taking birth control in order to conceive, it because the change in the men that they're attracted to is different, particularly women who are taking the hormonal birth control are stuck in the luteal phase or assimilated luteal phase of the cycle where the body essentially already thinks that it's pregnant. Because of this, women are attracted to men who are non-compatible with major histocompatibility complex, which is essentially the closest thing to human pheromones that we've more or less discovered. It's an olfactory, like it's a smell. You can put a man's sweat on a piece of paper and put it under a woman's nose, and she can basically has different reactions to it of attractiveness to that man. It's not exactly hormones,
if I may. So you're saying that when a woman is not on the pill, mm-hmm. she is attracted to essentially sort of like ideal levels of genetic similarity. Yeah.
Yes, right. It's ideal similarity and dissimilarity, because of course we wouldn't want to be attracted to a sibling, but it's ideal similarity and dissimilarity. Whereas women who are taking the pill are attracted to men who are less masculine and are not major histocompatibility complex compatible.
Less masculine.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they be attracted to men that are less masculine?
My hypothesis on that is probably because the body already thinks it's pregnant. So you don't need a masculine man. You want like a protective figure. You want more women maybe to help, come around you and protect you in that way. Not so interested in the more masculine man at that point.
Yes, I spoke to a woman who once had a boyfriend but was also having an affair, and she found the more masculine, dominant, more successful man attractive at one point in her cycle, mm-hmm. and then at another point in her cycle she was attracted to her cock beater boyfriend.
Exactly. That's the luteal phase, which is the right before menstruation. Basically, your body doesn't know if it's pregnant or not. So the assumption is yes. I'm being very colloquial with the way I'm describing the system. But because of that, and that's how the pill locks women into that stage of thinking it's constantly in that stage. And in fact, most women get told when they're taking the pill to never stop taking it. Sometimes they'll tell you to stop taking it for a couple of days to kind of reset it. But a lot of times doctors will tell women to just take it for 30 days and then start the next pack. And then they do have placebos in there, but women tell them not to take the placebos. They tell them to just keep injecting their bodies with this hormone constantly. And then they do it for years.
So what that would mean is you could imagine a relationship starting between a woman and mm-hmm. a compatible, histocompatible, high status, masculine man. And then they start having sex and she goes on the pill and then she won't find him attractive anymore. She'll want to go for some cock.
Well, I think it more often than not happens the other way around, because it's something like, I've seen statistics on it. It's something like 33%, about a third of all women at any point in time are taking hormonal birth control, some form of it. But it's something up to 80% or near that of women who have ever been on hormonal birth control, of women alive today. So basically what happens is that women get put on hormonal birth control as a form of managing period cramps, as a form of managing acne, as a form of anything, basically everything that happens to women's bodies as they develop in adolescence. Hormonal birth control is used as a panacea for. So a large amount of young women go on hormonal birth control when they are 13, 14 years old, and they don't go off it until they decide they want to have a baby when they're 35. And now they've been married to a man for 10 years.
Sorry. 13 years old.
It's about the average.
That's insane. Isn't that going to, that their brain is still developing. And hormones are so important to how women operate and think and so on. Their brains are still developing. So this is going to make them develop in an unnatural kind of way. Isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it is used again. It is used to treat acne. So, which, you know, when you're going through puberty, you're going to get acne. You're going to, things are going to be awkward. There's a lot of, because your body is being flooded with hormones, it's a lot of like emotional stuff too, weight gain and things like this, though. And they'll prescribe it for anything. They will prescribe it if you say, my period, it causes cramps and I'm in pain, here's hormonal birth control. That'll fix it. It's all off-label uses for it, of course, right? I mean, we know what the real purpose of birth control is, which is to prevent pregnancy. But it does have all these off-label uses. And the off-label uses are things like treating acne. Things like supposedly making your periods more manageable. But 13, 14, about the start of menstruation is when a lot of young girls start going on.
Mm-hmm. So that means that these women then, not in addition to all of the other things that are making them unhappy, because they're in an evolutionary mismatch where they should want to have children, have babies, mm-hmm. look after children, but they're being pressured to have a career. They're also likely, if they're on the pill, to enter into problematic relationships.
Yes. And like I said, because they it's so common to get started so young. It's less, I think it's less common to have a woman who finds like a Chad or an attractive, compatible man in terms of genetic compatibility, and then go on the pill. What seems to be the case, and I think one of the reasons for the extremely high divorce rate, is women get into relationships with these sort of soy boy cucks who agree with them on everything, of course. Yes, honey, are total pushovers. Then they decide they want to have a baby because she's 35 or whatever, goes off the pill and finds him repulsive.
Do you experience this yourself?
No, I've never. Well, I don't take the pill for obvious reasons. No, I don't take it after I learned about all that stuff. And I hadn't taken it for years at that point either, because I could tell that it was not something that was probably a good thing to do longitudinally, even before I did research on it.
Oh, wouldn't it affect how their bodies develop? I mean, women's bodies develop because of hormones, and you're at 13, your body hasn't developed fully yet, so it's going to interfere with the development of the body.
I can only imagine. I've not looked into that, but I can't imagine it wouldn't have some effect longitudinally, because exactly as you say, your body is developing. So if you're locking a young girl's body in the luteal phase of essentially the simulated pseudo-pregnancy, it has to probably have some strange effect.
We put on weight, things like that.
Well, that's one of the major side effects of hormonal birth control is weight gain.
Okay, so this is a two-pronged problem then. So when the pill was developed in, was it the 60s? It was considered to be, wow, women are now free. They can have sex. They can work. They can do whatever. They can just be like men. You have the one problem is that they're unlikely to be fulfilled by work in the same way that men are. This is why, as we see, they want to have this work-life balance where they'll train to be doctors, and then they'll want to go part-time eventually and all this sort of thing, which costs the British taxpayer a lot of money. And secondly, then, as you say, they're going to get into these relationships with these cuck men and then eschew them once they're pregnant. I mean, this is going to cause really serious emotional harm, I would have thought, then to them and their children.
And when she goes off the pill, is it that man's child? Because who she goes off the pill, all of a sudden she finds him repulsive, but now she's trying to get pregnant. So I also think that's a major reason for so much of the infidelity. Because she doesn't find that man attractive anymore. And it's sadly common. And I think it's a major contributor to the high divorce rate, where again, it's a no-fault divorce. Women can get divorced for any reason. There's basically nothing men can do about it, particularly in terms of paternity rights.
And so suddenly, this man that she's liked for ages and ages, you know, maybe even 10 years, will give her, I believe, what's known as the ick.
Yes, the ick. That's the
expand term. Can you expand on the, as a woman, can you expand for my viewers on the ick?
I don't really know. I suppose it's just when it's probably some cognitive heuristic or like, you know, paracognitive heuristic where you can just tell that man is dangerous, the same way that you would have a instantaneous reaction to a stick in the grass as expecting it to be a snake. That's why I'm using the term heuristic. But I think there's just something, and maybe it might be major histocompatibility complex, but I think women are evolved a little bit to be able to detect danger in certain people. So that's what I would think of when I would say the ick, when you can just look at a person and tell if they've got the sanpaku eyes, the three whites, or that's certainly a major factor. But the ick in terms of relationships is just, this man is probably not compatible with me genetically, and he's not masculine, and I don't think he can take care of me, at least in a historical sense, right? Because today you can be taken care of by a man who works a really crappy job, you know, but can support you financially, but doesn't have the masculine traits that women would want to pass on to their children otherwise, to be successful from an evolutionary standpoint.
And presumably, if the pill suppresses the ability to discern histocompatibility, then when they stop taking the pill, not only will they find this guy less gradually, presumably it's a gradual process, but less sexually attractive, but also they will be less able to get pregnant by him because they are not histocompatible. They will be more likely to miscarry.
Yes. So it ends up being everyone in this situation gets harmed by it. I've frequently said that that hormonal birth control, female hormonal birth control, has been one of the most devastating things to affect human society in the last 100 years. And its effect, I think, is very frequently downplayed, considering the number of women who are on it and the pretty severe effects that it has.
And what are the psychological? So if you imagine, like, we now have a society where there's all these women in positions of power, positions of influence, which didn't used to be the case, of course. I mean, when I was a kid, everybody that was important in England, except the prime minister, was a man. So you've got these members of parliament, the people that are these people, and they're on the pill. So they're in that phase. Mm-hmm. Well, I forget the word you used.
The tail
phase. Mm-hmm. So what's that going to do? Like, if these women are politicians or judges or we had the Spice Girl government in Finland some mm-hmm. years ago. Yeah, we had these five women running Finland, four of whom were menstrual, and may well have been on the pill. So they're running Finland. So mm-hmm. I had this idea at the time that maybe like their periods would coordinate. And once a month, every month, suddenly Vladimir Putin would be getting messages that Finland is very angry with Russia and intends to invade, and all its guns are pointed at Russia. And Mr. President, you have to be careful. The Finnish government are very angry. And then once a month, every month, then Finland is saying to Putin, "Okay, let's be part of Russia. Let's stop being independent. We love you." Now that's if they were. If they are going through the menstrual cycle, but if they were into the tail phase, then what would their constant attitude be towards Russia?
Well, you still, yeah, I guess they still menstruate though. So if they are taking the pill normally, you can take, again, if you don't take the 4 days or 5 days, whatever it is of the placebo, then you do menstruate normally. If you don't take those placebo pills, you just will not menstruate. So you can actually choose to not have a period. And so when I said some doctors will recommend that for some women,
I believe it's called double packing.
Yeah. Or something like that. But, if you are taking it with the placebo and cycling, yes, I could see the PMS sort of thing that you described there as being possible. But if they're stuck in the luteal phase, I can't imagine it would change behaviors. There's the opposite effect with men too. So there's been a study that found that men throw more or give more tips to strippers when they're not on birth control. So right. It actually makes men less attracted to women as well. So it goes both ways on that. But I would imagine it has to affect.
They can tell that a woman is not likely to get pregnant, and therefore they are less attracted to her.
Yes,
that makes sense, doesn't it? That makes sense.
Right. What if she can tell from the scent? I'm using that colloquially again because it's not really olfactory. But if women can tell from the scent, then it makes sense that men can tell. And vice versa.
Well, I'm under the impression that when a woman is ovulating, her skin mm-hmm. gets lighter.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that this is one of the reasons why men are in all cultures generally attracted to lighter skinned females, mm-hmm. because it tricks them into thinking that they're ovulating and therefore mm-hmm. they're sexier. So I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood in asking you the question. If they were in that tail phase, mm-hmm. how would it affect generalized behavior, generalized attitudes towards life?
Right. I'm not sure in terms of generalized behavior. The research I've looked at has mostly been on attraction and the relationship with men. But I would imagine that if it's making women more attracted to men who are less masculine, mm-hmm. I could see why then you'd have a problem. You'd have a lot of female politicians have a problem with someone like, say, Vladimir Putin or Donald Trump.
Right, exactly. So you've got one of the reasons, that's what I was thinking of. So one mm-hmm. of the, what it would do is it would make the women, in a sense, even more. Almost ironically, because even more feminine oriented in a traditional way, it would make them even more sort of almost like conflict averse, perhaps.
Yes, because she's body thinks it's pregnant. Yes. So conflict averse, wanting to be near other women who can help, you know, come around and help with the eventual childcare or whatever, as you would have had in more of a tribal sort of society. I think that makes sense, but that's why it tends to be, and specifically, it is a preference towards feminine faces. So if you actually show women who are taking hormonal birth control two men's faces, and one is more objectively been rated as more, and by that I mean it's been rated by inter-raters as more feminine, they're more attracted to that face than a more masculine face.
Right. So this is going to have serious consequences then. Mm-hmm. If we think about, it's going to have like a double effect, that if we think about the way in which women have gradually taken over higher education, and particularly the humanities departments, but also increasingly science departments, then and just the society, then you're going to get A, being more concerned with feminine things, mm-hmm. i.e. purity, harm avoidance and equality.
Not purity. I don't think it's purity, actually. I think it's harm avoidance and perceived fairness in terms of the moral. Women and men are about equal on the purity foundation, I think. And I actually would like to see if women who are in the luteal phase are actually lower on purity. I don't have data on that.
I found studies indicating women were higher on purity, but
I think in some senses, but maybe the reason why that's the case is because of the number of women who take hormonal birth control. I hadn't actually thought about that. Why women and men are, obviously the Moore Foundation's research is new, it's in the last 20 years, a time during which, again,
they're more anxious.
Yes. There's a neuroticism element.
Yeah, one idea I had is that one of the reasons potentially why there was this massive backlash, and this imbricates what we're talking about more women in radical right movements, is that one of the reasons I wonder why there was this massive puritanical conservative reaction in the 19th century was because all of, against what had previously been a sexualized culture or whatever of the 18th century, or relatively so, is that you had all of these diseases that became endemic at once. And so suddenly you've gone from people just unpredictably dropping dead of cholera and whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's also syphilis became endemic.
Yes, yes.
And so you're going to get women reacting much more severely mm-hmm. to that. And then where women go, I suspect men go because men want to get the women.
Yes, right.
And so this is, I wonder as well, if that's true, if that's what's going on, if the presence of women in these movements, like of these traditional, whatever, WITAM, is indicative of things moving that way, because women don't like, insecurity. They want to be where the future more powerful men are going to be. They can read the room better. They can work out what's going on better. So does the growing number of women in a group like that imply that things are kind of shifting away from woke, do you think?
I never have any time. I'm extremely disorganized. Things basically overwhelm me. I don't know why this is. It's probably some sort of genetic thing. I'm basically present-oriented, a fast life history strategist. I really should find out more. And in order to do so, I should probably read this book, Blueprint by Robert Plomin. It's a fantastic book, and it looks at the genetics of our psychology, the genetic reasons why we have the kind of personalities we have, why we have the kind of intelligence we have. Maybe that would help me make sense of why I'm like I am. I should read that book. But the problem is, as we've established, I never have any time. So I don't really see how I can read it. Or so I thought, until I discovered Legion.com. What Legion.com does is it takes the most basic and interesting books, including Blueprint by Robert Plomin, and it summarizes them into just 25 minutes, and then it allows you to listen to those books. That's my problem solved. Legion.com. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then you will get 10% off. Legion.com. All the based knowledge from your phone straight into your brains.
Yes, and I think that is probably true, and I think it is a good indicator because, again, women are social selectors. They ultimately get to choose what men pass on their genes, really. So I think that when women are moving into a political or social movement like that, it does indicate that that's where they feel the future is. That's where they're going to feel, they feel more secure. They feel that this is the safe bet in order to, because women, again, are taking the safer routes in order to pass on their genes and the human and pass on, you know, human civilization or human society. So I think it does make sense that that would be a reason why you're seeing more women, because they can see where the tides are shifting and they want to be on the right course so they don't get left behind. And in addition to all the issues with the purity stuff, like I said, which I think does discuss them, and the hormonal birth control stuff, which is a factor.
Do you think that the transsexuality thing, which has become so prominent in the last 10 years, particularly disgusts women?
Yes, I it absolutely does. I think that's why it's been such a huge issue for women, particularly because it goes at odds with that Harm Care / Proceed Fairness Foundation and the very much kind of obsession that women in particular seem to have with those two morals of wanting to care for others, which again are good things that have been twisted by modernity. So wanting to care for others is a good thing. Wanting things to be fair is a good thing. But women have given all of this care and concern and fights for fairness of the rights of trans people only to have their own perceived rights that they were told were sacred. Women, you know, are equal to men in every way. And then it turns out that, well, no, they're not, because all these transgender athletes are outcompeting you. They're performing better in the workplace than you in terms of productivity, because men tend to be more productive than women in the workplace. They tend to go for these STEM jobs in particular. You find a lot of transsexuals in STEM areas, particularly in computer programming. These places that women have been saying that they really want to be equally represented in sports and in the workforce. And so all of their care and compassion and fight for fairness is getting beaten up by the fact that men are different than women, which is the antithesis of what they believe.
This tension, though, whereby women seem to be overwhelmingly represented in terms of things like the George Floyd Black Lives Matter nonsense and all of this other stuff. So on the one hand, you've got these women that are reacting against it, and but on the other hand, the TERF feminists or whatever you want to call them. But then on the other hand, there's so many women that are just hyper woke and will say at least, oh well, yeah, trans women are real women, and oh, right. You know, it's not. Why is that? Why do they do that?
Well, again, it's where is the social power? Where and for many years, obviously, the power and the institutional power in particular was in the woke, was in the far left. They controlled the universities. They control pretty much, you know, every cultural institution. And so, of course, women wanted to side with that. And it speaks again to the compassionate element that women possess of, don't you want to care for these poor people? Look, they're being abused. They're being oppressed. They're being killed by police or whatever it is. And so it's a twisting and a warping of women's inherent desire to care for things, it bastardized into this misplaced care. And they don't have children, so they don't know where to place their care.
Ah, so, okay. You think that's germane to it, that a lot of them, because they're in an evolutionary mismatch, they almost like want to find an ersatz child.
Yes, which is a cat lady thing.
Yeah, so for them, the refugee, the violent refugee male that comes in, and he's helpless, poor thing. It seems he's almost like something to be mothered.
Yes, I think that's exactly what it is. That's the cat lady thing. That's the massive importation of immigrants. Oh, these poor little babies. They just want to have a home. It doesn't matter that they're murderers and rapists. They don't, because they're not thinking about that. They're thinking again from the motherly, compassionate sort of harm versus care perspective. That's my hypothesis, at least.
Right, and so then, as long as women are on that side, then you're going to. So what do you think is it that's causing women to gradually switch away from that? And it's some sort of ability to. You think it would be the more socially skilled women that would smell the air and realize the way things were shifting? Because the impression I get is it's the more autistic sort of women.
Yes.
The opposite.
Yeah, I think you have to be a little bit autistic. I mean, I certainly am too. I think to judge it at this point as maybe moving in a different direction. It's also not socially acceptable, and women want to be socially acceptable. Now, it's socially acceptable within this small little group that, or these groups of people that are forming now and becoming more organized. But broadly speaking, it is not socially acceptable. You still lose your job. You will still be expunged from whatever organization you work in if you express a lot of these beliefs publicly. So it is dangerous in that sense for women to do it, and that's why the majority do not and are going to stick still for now, even as the woke is being put away, are going to probably still stick on that side as the safer bet. But I think, yes, it's probably the more autistic women who are maybe thinking a little bit further down the line. And also it's because what does the right offer that the left is not? Children, family, traditional values. And women do actually want that. Women have largely been oftentimes the champions of traditional values throughout human history, quite staunchly so. Because they help women. They are in place that largely to facilitate and to help women.
Aren't they controlling women's sexuality and things like this and forcing them to, you know, have their feet bound and wear veils and whatever else? What do you say to those that would say that patriarchy is terrible for women? It controls them and they can't do what they want.
I think most, but probably not all for sure, because statistics never applies to all people, statistical average. Most women would probably be happier with someone telling them what to do. I mean, look at the common trope of, where do you want to go to dinner? Ask a woman where she wants to go to dinner. And you end up in an hour-long conversation where, I don't know. It's because she wants you to tell her where to go. Women want to be told what to do by men.
Okay. Where would you like to go for dinner, Aiden?
Unfortunately, I've got somebody leftovers, not anywhere tonight, but I'd have to ask my husband.
Not tonight. Ask your
husband. Ask
your husband to take you for dinner, and I'll decide where. And by the way, it will be an Indian restaurant. And it won't be some Ponzi Indian restaurant, a Bangladeshi restaurant with food that I've heard of. Anyway, so all right, I see. So could you tell me a bit, moving away from that? So you as a woman. So how did your journey into BASEDness start? What is your back? what is your background? Where are you from? How did this happen?
Well, I'm from the US. Grew up as a young kid in West Virginia, which is very, very rural state. It gets made fun of by the American media constantly for being a bunch of backwards, hillbilly, stupid white people. You know, it's the butt of jokes and has been for decades. Most people outside of the US only really know it for that John Denver song. That's all right. It's a good song.
I know it for snake handling churches.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've seen that. I've seen it in real life as a kid. I saw them do the snake charming stuff. They do exist. Those are real.
Jolo, West Virginia. There have been a number of academic studies of that. But then the pastor was bitten to death by snakes. Right. So in my search for a snake handling church, I then had to go to Tennessee. Mm. But okay. So from rural West Virginia, and then you went to University of West Virginia.
I moved to Baltimore when I was 11. Baltimore City, which is like one of the crime capitals of the United States, that was a very big culture shock. To go from rural West Virginia, because my parents got divorced, so I moved with my mother to Baltimore. And that was a big culture shock. I went to an art school, or an art high school, so I also got a very weird background in art, classical training, painting, drawing. I went to undergraduate in Cincinnati, Ohio, at Xavier University for communication. Xavier, X-A-V-I-E-R, mm-hmm. Catholic Jesuit University. I went there, I got a degree in psychology, a degree in communication and public relations with a minor in psych. Got my master's degree at West Virginia University in communication with an emphasis on media psychology. And I was a PhD student there, communication, emphasis, media psychology, but I dropped out because it was, for a lot of reasons. It got very, very stressful and I was very unhappy. So maybe at some point I'll finish it, but I don't know.
Yes, you on an interview I saw with our friend Benjamin Boyce, mm-hmm. you give me the impression that you went completely mad. I mean, you had a kind of breakdown.
Yeah.
Why did this happen?
I think, well, they made university made an error that I don't want to belabor, but they made an error. They couldn't, regarding my records, they couldn't admit that it was a clerical error that someone in the office did. They couldn't admit to this error. So they blamed me for it and then used that as an excuse to kind of use me as the department punching bag. But then when I started to do work and started to publish research and started to do very well in the program, I think they got a little scared that I was going to be their colleague in the future. So they started, some of it was done, I think, as a kindness to give me more things to do, more classes to teach, more classes to take, more work to, more research projects, more time in the lab, et cetera. But it ended up getting to the point where I was working for over 100 hours a week. I'm like just incredibly long hours and days doing all these projects. And I had so many things to manage. I just went nuts. It was too much to handle for someone who'd never done anything like that before. I mean, I'd worked in the workforce, but it just got to be too much. And so I had to take time off. I went crazy. I went into a mental institution because I just thought I...
You went into a mental... You told Benjamin that you tried to commit suicide.
Yeah. This is a long time ago now, but it was...
How on earth could it get to that stage?
Well, I felt like I had no support within the university either. So they were asking me to do all these things and I would do them and I'd excel at it. But then anytime there was even like some minor... anything that I could be criticized for would be an enormous blow up of, they'd reprimand me in front of the whole class and no one else ever, they'd ever did that to. It was very weird. I don't know what happened. Like I think what it was is they screwed up. They couldn't accept that they screwed up. So they blamed me and then they wanted me to fail. So they intentionally gave me all this stuff to do. That's my hypothesis. Maybe they were just trying, they thought they were helping me out. I'm really not sure which one's correct because I can't mind read.
Quite a broad conspiracy theory. So you ended up in a psychiatric hospital. Mm-hmm. And how did you end, how did you gradually get out of that?
Well, I think they put me in there for 6 weeks on like a mental health hold. And then when I came out, I obviously couldn't go back. So I took the rest of the semester off for sabbatical. and I couldn't not work. I had to be doing something. I don't personally understand people who can just kind of sit around and play video games all day or watch TV. I mean, from time to time, that's fine, but I have to be working and researching or something. And that's when I got really into politics, because it was during the 2016 election cycle. Mm-hmm. And that was fascinating just to observe from a purely social science perspective of people's reactions to it, really to Trump. The whole thing was fascinating. So I got really into politics then, and I was used to call my dad every day and talk to his head off about politics. And he said, well, why don't you go make a YouTube channel and talk into the void about it instead of talking to me? So
that's what you did.
Yep.
And how did you come up with this pseudonym, Aiden Paladin?
Oh, it was I used to play a video game called Final Fantasy XI, online game. I just randomly generated the name Aiden, and I was a paladin, so that's it. And they sort of rhyme, so went with that.
You were a paladin. What is a paladin?
In that game, it's like a knight that heals people.
Okay.
So yeah, you're a holy warrior.
This is a very autistic thing to be.
Yes,
into.
it's very autistic, yes. I'm sorry.
And autistic people feel feelings more strongly. They feel the sensations of their own bodies more strongly. They feel anxiety more strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're therefore more prone to mental breakdowns.
Yeah.
I think that was germane to what was going on.
Probably. Most likely. Because I did feel like I was being singled out and... Yeah, and it felt very lonely. And I was being like yelled at all the time by my professors. Not my advisor. My advisor was lovely. But it was pretty much only her who was looking out for me. And I have received post facto apologies from a lot of the staff for what happened in the years since.
And so, and what was the sub? What were you pursuing for your doctorate?
Communication with an emphasis on media psychology. I helped along with my advisor and her husband. So I kind of had two advisors: the National Communication Association Conference, Video Games Studies Caucus, and also at the International Communication Association. The Video Game Studies Caucus, excuse me. That was my main area of research was video game studies.
But you moved into politics, and I thought the area that you did a presentation on, the WITAM, was very interesting in terms of what's happening at the moment. So could you possibly expand on that?
What it basically, the gist of it was that the democratic process made people very miserable. Even thinking about politics, thinking about your participation in politics, tends to increase people's reports of depression, stress, anxiety. And it gets worse near elections, but it appears to be compound in that there isn't really a release valve after the end of an election. It's a little bit of a release, but it still is compounding and making it worse. Basically, it's only when people totally get away from politics that they can start to get away from the stress that it causes. So the constant deluge of political information that people are exposed to, particularly in the modern media landscape, is making them miserable. It's one of many, many things. Of course, which is why we find these increasing rates of depression and mental illness in society.
So exposure to politics makes people unhappy.
Seems so.
They'd rather not know about it.
Yeah, which is, I think, why a major flaw with democracy, because it forces every single individual voter to be sovereign in terms of making decisions for themselves. And much like how women don't like making decisions, nobody really likes to make decisions, I don't think. When it's something like that, that's so major, that requires you to have so much information about a given subject, that's not really possible for any individual person to have information about all of these topics, even with access to the internet. You know, even the most intelligent person can't be an expert on absolutely everything. And politics requires every single individual citizen be an expert on politics to actually understand. Most people just don't have the time nor cognitive energy to be able to expand on that.
I understand that the King of Bhutan toyed with introducing some form of democracy or something like this, and that many, many people in Bhutan genuinely petitioned him to not do this and said that, please, Your Majesty, we want you to make these decisions. And that Bhutan, is more interested in gross national happiness, that is the policy of the King of Bhutan, than gross national product or whatever, how much you produce. And this is why, based on this, Bhutan banned television until quite recently, and even now limits it. It forces weird opening hours of shops, so you can't buy things on certain days. And it doesn't want tourists to the extent that it makes it very difficult, very expensive for you to go and be a tourist in Bhutan. So it's almost like the King of Bhutan wants to keep Bhutan in this kind of pre-modern medieval bliss, almost something like out of traditionalism, out of René Guénon or something, where you're connected to the mystical, but you certainly don't have things like democracy, because this makes people unhappy. Is this our evolutionary match, to live in a kind of basically benevolent monarchy?
That's my belief, yes, or my hypothesis.
Are you ready for the future of the West?